Welcome to the Intelligent Investing Podcast, where modern portfolio theory can suck it. A student of the school of Graham and Doddsville and a clergy member of the Church of Warren Buffett, here's your host, Eric Schlein.
Hi, this is Eric Schlein. You are listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast. Today we're going to talk about the recent market correction. And it's New Year's Eve as I am talking to you in the evening. We had a short trading session today. I'm going to be doing this solo today. And for those of you who maybe consider themselves, you know, very experienced value investors who really aren't worried about what's going on, this episode probably isn't something for you. However, if you are someone listening, and you're someone who's either been a fan of the show or a new listener to the show, and you know, you might have some concerns, you might be confused about what's going on, then this episode definitely is for you. I'm not going to be giving stock advice or any advice on what you should or shouldn't do, but hopefully can give you some clarity so you can be empowered to make a intelligent decision on your own. So let's get started. For a little background, the Herald Tribune posted an article on their website tonight saying, what does it mean when a stock enters a bear market? This is by Alex Vega. I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name. Alex, apologize if I'm mispronouncing your last name. V-E-I-G-A, Associated Press business writer. So, you know, he says Wall Street's sharp downturn beginning in October has pulled the NASDAQ composite into what's known as a bear market. The benchmark S&P 500 index is in what Wall Street calls a correction and is headed towards the bear market, threatening to end more than a nine-year U.S. bull market run. So here are some common questions asked about bear markets, corrections, and what it means for the average investor. And what he goes on to talk about is that a correction is Wall Street's term for an index or even an individual stock that has fallen 10% or more from a recent high. So the S&P, the Dow, and the NASDAQ entered a correction this month. The NASDAQ slid into a bear market Friday as a sell-off in Apple, Google's parent Alphabet, and other big names weighed on the technology-heavy index. It's also the first year since World War II that the S&P 500 has two corrections in the same calendar year. All told, the Dow has fallen 16.3% below its record close. The S&P has slumped down 17.5% from its high, and the NASDAQ is down 21.9% below its peak on August 29th. So I'm not going to read the rest of the article, but I wanted to just delve into, I guess, some practical, you know, this is just my thinking, and so you can have a practical use for this so-called wisdom. So I think the first thing to talk about is holding cash a good idea? And this is something that comes up quite a bit. Anytime one of these corrections happen, and whether, you know, this goes on and drags out more months or more years, there's no way for me to know. Some people claim they know. I've seen very few people predict that accurately over the course of an investment lifetime. But here's what's going to happen is you'll have talking heads come on CNBC, and you'll have the fund managers who are holding lots of cash, and they're all going to look like geniuses. The thing is, though, most of these people were not holding cash every other time, right? So if you have a marketplace with millions and millions of participants, there's going to be someone who held cash this time, and then there's going to be a smaller percentage of those people who held cash this time and also held cash when we had the recession a little over 10 years ago. So those people statistically are just going to look like, you know, brilliant geniuses. How much of that is skill and how much of that is luck? It's hard to think that most of that is going to be skill. And the reason is that there's lots of people who are making economic predictions. But if you're to make money on a macro thesis, you have to be right about a lot of things. So first of all, you actually have to be right about your thesis. So you have to say, okay, I think this will happen in the economy, which then will cause the market to decline, right? So you have to be right about that. Then on top of that, not only do you have to be right about the actual thing that's going to happen, you also have to be right about what kind of asset classes are going to make you money. So sometimes you might think, here is actually a perfect example, right? So 10 years ago, there was a lot of people, including myself, who were worried about the Federal Reserve continuing to print lots and lots and lots of money. So one of the ways that people played that is they started buying into commodity companies and gold mining stocks and sold off a lot of wonderful companies. And there are people today who are still on the sidelines from 10 years ago. So sure, they might be celebrating right now because the market had a 20%-ish correction, but they've also missed on the growth from 2008 all the way up to 2018. And corporate profits are up quite a bit since then. So that is real intrinsic value. That is real growth that has come into the market in the last 10 years that some of those people have missed out on because they were, perennial cynics, right? So they're every year they're called perma bears. So every year they come out and they think some kind of market crash is going to happen, and occasionally they get it right. But the portfolio track records on those people tend to be pretty bad. So that's the other thing. And then so you have to be right about the macro thesis. You have to be right in the way that it's going to actually make you money, right? So you have to pick the right kinds of asset classes. The third thing is then you actually have to get in at the bottom. So, everyone says I want to buy low and sell high. But typically what people do is they sell low and buy high. And you can see that in the, I read a statistic, this might be wrong, but it was something like the average individual investor tends to only make about 20%, capture about 20% of the market return over an investment lifetime, right? So that means if you're, the market's doing 10% a year, that average investor tends to do about 2% a year. So that includes lots of day trading, or lots of just short-term trading in general, where you're going to trigger short-term capital gains taxes. Even if you're going in and out of things every year and a half, that's still triggering lots of capital gains taxes long-term as well. Furthermore, on top of that, people tend to want to put in more cash at the worst time and then get out at also the worst time. So right now, there are going to be people liquidating their portfolios, selling out of everything because they're scared there's going to be another decline of 20, 30, 40, 50% of their capital. And that might be the case. But what it doesn't take into account is what is the intrinsic value of the businesses in their portfolio. Most people don't know. So is holding cash a good idea? I generally err on the side of not holding cash and being fully invested unless there was really nothing to buy. But if you're someone who either is doing fundamental analysis, if you're dealing with capital of under $100 million, you will probably find things to buy. I know a few people who say have 10-20% in cash. I've met one or two people who had like 70-80% in cash. But generally, you can do quite well being fully invested most of the time. So there's a friend of mine, Travis Widower. I might be mispronouncing his last name too, which is embarrassing because I've had him on like two or three times on my show already. But Travis, I'm going to link to the article on the podcast notes. But Travis wrote a good article dated January 25th, 2018, so the beginning of this year, on his blog, and it's called Is Holding Cash a Good Idea? So he says, over long enough time periods, the stock market has always performed well. There are always plenty of bumps and bruises along the way, but the overall trend has always been up and to the right. In fact, the worst total return in history over a 20-year period was 54%. The worst 30-year return was plus 854%. We've all seen images like this one below that shows this never-ending march up, and he shows a graph, you know, from a little before 1900 to the present day. Even when markets are high, as many people believe them to be now, the future expected returns from the stock market are still positive. I think this is an important distinction because I've talked to many people who think that because the market is high, a crash must be inevitable, and thus future returns will be negative. If the market is in fact too high right now, which we won't know for another 5 to 10 years when we can look back, that means the future returns will be lower than historical averages, but not negative. Though I don't put much value in people's opinions who try to estimate future stock market returns, almost all the estimates that I've seen are in the low to mid single digits, call it 4%. 4% isn't great, but it's a hell of a lot better than earning 0% in cash. If the above is true, and the stock market always has a positive expected value, shouldn't we always be 100% invested? The usual reasons given from investors, myself included, to hold cash are 1. Cash is optionality. If the market tanks, holding cash allows us to be nimble and quickly take advantage of cheap stocks. As a side note, so this is not in the article, but what I was talking about before is you have to be able to time the bottom to make money on this stuff. So right now, let's say the market goes down another 30%, and now things are really cheap, and I'm able to find some really terrific companies selling at like 7, 8, 10 times earnings. And I think those corporate profits are real, and those earnings will continue to grow. Some of that would be a no-brainer. Are those people who were scared now going to be putting money back in then, or are they going to wait for another 30-40% decline? So the problem is that a lot of people who wait to time the bottom never actually get back in at the bottom, and by the time they get back up, back in, now they have there's the term called FOMO, the fear of missing out. So now they have the fear of missing out, and then they're getting back in right when it's too late again, and now they really screwed things up for themselves. So they're selling at the worst times and buying at the worst times, and then people wonder why they're the average return for the individual investor is so low even compared to just a basic index fund. So back to the article. Number one, cash is optionality. If the market tanks, holding cash allows us to be nimble and quickly allows us to take advantage of cheap stocks. Number two, there is nothing cheap to invest in. Definitely been here before, like right now, for example. And that's true. The last few months, there were less opportunities available. That being said, I still did see opportunities available, and those opportunities have now gotten cheaper. Three, behavioral/psychological reasons, such as peace of mind, etc. The third one is very personal to each person's situation and mindset, but I'm not sure the first two hold up to scrutiny. If the broad market is a bet that wins more often than not, and it's a bet we can always make, then any time we want to own cash, shouldn't we just own a broad stock market index fund like SPY, which tracks the S&P 500? On the first point from above, SPY might as well have the same optionality as cash because I can buy and sell it instantly. SPY's average daily volume in the past 3 months is over $20 billion. On the second point, even if there are no good individual stocks to invest in, a broad stock market index fund that has a positive expected value is better than cash at 0%. Whether conscious or subconscious, I feel like a lot of investors, again myself included, actually hold cash as a way to time the market, even though none of us claim to do it. Maybe some cognitive dissonance here. Or because we manage other people's money and are embarrassed to invest in an index fund, which makes sense. Paying someone to invest in an index fund does sound pretty stupid. But market timing and or pressure from outside investors aren't great reasons. I believe very few people can time the market consistently, and thus the rest of us should probably just be 100% invested and benefit from the market's inevitable march upwards over the long term. If an investor averages, say, a 10% cash position per year, which is low for a lot of investors, and the stock market returns 8% per year over the long term, that investor is costing themselves 0.8% a year by not putting cash by not putting their cash into a broad market index fund. If the starting account value was $100,000 and 10% was in cash, that would be $10,000 in cash to start. If the $10,000 is always invested in broad market index funds earning 8% on average, that 10% that $10,000 would grow to over $43,000 by year 20. If I put it in cash, that 10% that $10,000 would grow to exactly $10,000 by year 20. Okay, you'd probably get a little interest on that cash. If the cash was able to earn somewhere, say 1% a year, it would grow to just over $12,000 by year 20. $43,000 versus $12,000 is a big difference. Missing out on a 0.8% per year doesn't sound like a big deal, but it can add up to a lot of money. I asked several money managers I talked to about their views on holding cash and got some quality input. I thought Fred Liu did a great job of describing the trade-off mathematically. Quote, the other way to think about it is yes, you're giving up, say, 8% a year with the trade-off that a recession slash bear market should bring it down, call it 40%. With the assumption you can call a bottom, which is a big assumption, you're basically assuming a bear market will come in the next 4.5 years if you're holding cash today. But note at the core, this is a market timing call. My takeaway is that for it to be mathematically correct to hold a meaningful amount of cash, meaningful cash position, one has to believe the market is going to have frequent and or very deep downturns. The above also generously assumes the person who invests their cash position near the market bottom, which we know isn't usually the case. A lot of investors would actually have a bigger cash position at the bottom because the 40% drop they just experienced scared the S out of them. I think an attitude of always being 100% invested can protect a lot of investors from these kinds of behaviors and cognitive biases that can hurt their long-term results. Of the money managers that I've talked to about this, every single one cited some sort of behavioral or psychological reason for wanting to hold cash. Samir Patel brought up an interesting point that I hadn't considered myself. Quote, in theory, you always want to swap the apparent 17% IRR investment rate of return for the apparent 21.6% investment rate of return. But in practice, I find that it's usually hard to value things that precisely or anticipate when that value will be realized. As such, I find it hard to rob Peter to pay Paul. It's easier for me to manage the portfolio when the decision to buy, sell one stock is mostly discrete from another. I think that makes a lot of sense. I've gone through that process many times where I'm 100% invested and want to add to a new position. Then I have to figure out what holdings to trim or sell completely to make room for that new position. That decision-making process may very well be improved if those buy and sell decisions are completely discrete and not influenced by each other. Two other investors I talked to about this brought up holding Berkshire Hathaway as a placeholder for cash. But they also mentioned that selling Berkshire may be difficult to replace with another company. Thus, Berkshire in theory sounds like a good placeholder for cash, but it could easily turn into a normal position. My hunch is that owning SPY would not have the same psychological commitment, but maybe not. SPY is still a distinct position you have to sell to make room for something new. And if your SPY position is down, it may be difficult to sell thanks to how averse humans are to taking losses, which is called loss aversion. As I've been thinking about this concept the past few weeks, I went back and looked at some of my own purchases from the past year, and three stood out. First, the big addition that I made to Franklin Covey position in mid-2017 that took my sizing from the low teens to the high 20s when I had a big cash position. I wonder if I would have made the same addition if I was 100% invested and buying more Franklin Covey required me to sell other positions. I sure hope I would have if all I had to do was sell SPY, but I don't know. The other two purchases that stood out were almost identical. Callaway's Nursery put out great earnings after market close, so I put in buy orders immediately because I had the cash sitting around and was able to get a small number of shares at the market open. I've made similar smaller additions in positions several times over the past couple of years, but it's only possible in microcaps where new information is not immediately reflected in the stock price, and when cash is sitting in the account. If I had all my cash invested in SPY, by the time I sold SPY and tried to buy Callaway's Nursery at the market open, I may not have gotten my shares, but who knows? So if you invest in microcaps, I think this is a very legitimate reason to have a small amount of cash sitting around, maybe 3 to 10%. But those opportunities are never available in larger companies. Despite what the above sounds like, always being 100% invested isn't yet an investment philosophy of mine, though I think the logic is sound so far. I've held plenty of cash over the years, but whether or not that's a smart thing to do is something I've been challenging myself on recently. Quote, cash is optionality, is one of these market truisms that almost everyone believes, but I'm not convinced it's right in the long term. I think, quote, liquidity is optionality, is closer to the truth, and a lot of things other than cash are extremely liquid. My current thinking is, if the market always has a positive expected value, there's no reason to ever hold a meaningful amount of cash versus a broad liquid index fund. And then Travis leaves us with this quote. It's by Peter Lynch, and Peter goes, far more money has been lost by investors preparing for corrections or trying to anticipate corrections than has been lost in corrections themselves. I think that's very powerful. Now, there's a varying view. So I got an email just the other day from a friend of mine, and I'm not going to say his name on the air, but I'm going to read you one of the emails he sent me just so you can get an idea of the thinking of people who do think they can market time and are concerned about the economy. So he says, this is the email I got 2 days ago, December 22nd at 1:56 in the morning. There are multiple asset bubbles and systemic risk within the banking system related to fraud and money laundering that will bring down everything. And then in parentheses, it says, check the Panama Papers and look at Deutsche Bank and Goldman. Corporate profits are meaningless with these systemic threats. The market, pensions, and home values will collapse, which triggers lower consumer demand, which affects all companies, regardless of the strength of their underlying business fundamentals. This will be much worse than 2008. That was just mortgages. This is also mortgages, but plus corporate debt, plus student loans, plus pensions, plus sovereign debt, all in the context of trade wars, nationalism, and declining population in the EU, Japan, and the worst population growth in the United States in 8 years. I completely pulled out of the market in May. I told the board of my company in January 2008 that we needed to sell the company because the economy was going to collapse in the fall, and that there was a real chance that the industry that I was in would become nationalized. That was not a popular opinion at the time, but it was 100% dead on. I'm going to leave a little bit of this email, but I've also been stressing the concept of pensions and Medicaid. This will turn out to be 100% accurate. The corporate profits that we have been fueled by $1 trillion in deficit spending. There is very little growth in the voluntary economy. The implosion of multiple asset bubbles plus demographics plus trade wars equals complete meltdown. I have been discussing this since May, and people now are only starting to take me seriously. Most people look at the world and look at the stock market. I'm paraphrasing what he's saying there, post World War II assumptions regarding the performance of markets within the United States as the hegemonic power. Far better to examine the last 6,000 years of history. So basically what he's saying in a nutshell is there's a lot of terrible things and going on. There's lots of terrible things within our system and systemic issues. And this is going to lead to a complete meltdown with the implosion of some of these asset bubbles plus trade wars and plus demographic trends. And that it's a fallacy to look at the United States and look at the stock market with these post-World War II assumptions that the market just always goes up and that will be a major power in the world. So that's his view. So what I responded is I said, I get all that. But I don't get how the profits, say, of Google or See's Candies, which is a Berkshire Hathaway subsidiary, can be deemed meaningless, though, in the face of that. I think it's incredibly unlikely that a company like that won't be making more money in 10 years than they are today. That's the connection. I don't make that all corporate profits today are BS. He responds to me and he says, it doesn't matter about over 10 years. The point is to buy low and sell high. I don't believe that Google or C's are immune to a massive financial collapse. The point is to buy the right things at the right time. And then he goes on to say, Google is down 30% this year. I think it goes down another 25 to 50%. Why would I buy Google now when I know that the things that are going to drive the market over the next 6 to 12 months will bring down Google with it? I've been telling people this for months, but almost no one listens and they've all gotten wrecked. We are nowhere near a bottom. I see no value in holding my money in assets whose value will be determined more by corrupt banks and politicians than on the merits of the performance. So there's a few things about that, which is that at the end of the day, if you look at, hundreds of years of stock market history and actually market history of any kind of security, as Benjamin Graham says, in the short term, the market is a voting machine. In the long term, the market is a weighing machine. So essentially, the intrinsic value of a business over time is what gets reflected in the price of that business or in a debt security, right? The intrinsic value of a bond will eventually get reflected. So actually, looking at a bond is a very easy way to analyze this. So let's say you had a bond of what's a stable company? Say we take Berkshire Hathaway or Johnson & Johnson, two companies that are very, very well capitalized and have plenty of assets on their balance sheet compared to their debt. So if I was to take a Johnson & Johnson bond or a Berkshire Hathaway bond, and it was a 10-year bond, and they said, we're going to pay out X percent every year on this bond, and the principal was $1,000, and the bond was selling for $998. You know what the interest on your money is, what you're going to get. So now let's say, for instance, there's a collapse, and that bond now goes from $998. And there's a 50% correction, right? And it's now at around, between $400 to $500. Now, if a Johnson & Johnson bond, a 10-year bond, was trading at half of its par value, and now all of a sudden that interest rate is significantly higher, that's The value of that asset is not being determined by a corrupt bank or a politician, because at the end of the day, as long as Johnson & Johnson can make that coupon payment, that's what's going to determine the value of that bond, not what a trader is going to do. Even if, let's say, the bond goes down even more, if it's a callable bond, then Johnson & Johnson can literally buy back the bond, or not callable, but J&J can maybe even buy back their own bonds at a significantly lower price than they issued it at. They can also do things such as, they'll be paying the coupon rate, so you're going to be getting payments on your principal regardless of what the price is. It's just now the yield is going to be higher. With a stock, those principles aren't any different. The only difference is that you don't know what the interest rate is on your stock position. Most likely, you can come up with some kind of guesstimate, which is where intrinsic value comes in. But unless you don't know you're not going to be able to predict the precise growth rates of free cash flow and corporate earnings for the next 20 years. So you're not going to be able to exactly know how you're going to get paid back, either through dividends or share buybacks, or say a company's retaining earnings and then investing those earnings and growing wealth even more, like a Berkshire or a Markel Corporation. So anyway, I responded to that email and I said, I think this is where our fundamental understanding differs. The value of Google is all the cash flows will ever produce discounted back to the present at a certain discount rate. That is not an opinion. That literally is what the intrinsic value is of a cash flow producing asset, whether it be a stock, bond, farm, or buying a rental property down the street. The principle still applies. I'm not saying to buy or not buy Google. However, for instance, there are, I talk about a company that owns some properties that are trading at about 60 cents on the dollar, their private market value. And then I say at the current price, I get paid a 10% yield on my cash just to sit there and wait without any kind of growth. If the market goes down and that security goes down along with it, I'll be able to buy more at an even greater discount to the intrinsic value of those properties, while the business can also buy back their own stock at higher and higher yields. To squabble over a 10, 20, or 30% change in the price of a company when you believe the business to be significantly undervalued does not make much sense and also makes the game much harder. Sure, if you don't believe that Goldman Sachs' book value really exists, then buying the stock below book value and when you believe that they'll have a much greater haircut in both book value and corporate profits, and you don't believe that the actual yield you'll get on that cash exists, then sure, I can also understand that. Also, if you have a business that is below intrinsic value, plus has lots of liquidity, plus has intelligent capital allocation, then in a scenario where there is a huge market decline and or an actual market headwind against the business, such in the cases you bring up, then that scenario will actually increase the intrinsic value of the business, not diminish it. You have to be right both about a market decline and then again timing the bottom. If you look at people with track records that go on for decades, it's very, 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 in all capital letters I put that in, hard to find people who have done this successfully over time. And usually those people who called something correctly like that are not able to replicate the call again, and or their track records are miserable as they miss out on, say, a 300% increase in the market over many years, and then they get to be right about some kind of 50% market correction years down the line, which is pretty much bound to happen regardless. So not saying you're wrong inherently, I have no idea either way. What I'm saying is you can still be right about the economics and still not end up with a very good long-term personal investment track record over time. And you understand math. You're a businessman. For compound interest to really take effect, you need to be thinking in decades. You can also be right economically, but then not know how to take advantage of it. Say you thought the Fed, Federal Reserve, was going to be printing lots of money, and then you wrongly predicted hyperinflation years ago. Or maybe you see a rise in commodity prices, but you buy gold miners whose equipment prices rise faster than the price of gold. All of these variables that you have to be right about, pick the right security, and then actually time the bottom and time the top. Is it possible to do all that? Yes, sure, maybe. To do that correctly, consistently for a lifetime of investing? And then I put in all capital letters. Very hard game. The latter is just a much easier... is just a much easier game, even with a knowing you'll end up buying securities that may end up having corrections of 50% or more in a given year. I mean, hell, Charlie Munger was down over 70% in the mid-70s, and he still finished out the decade outperforming the market, and I think it was something like six or seven times. I put seven times, so it might have been like six times. Either way, it's a lot. Berkshire has had corrections of 50% or more several times since the 1960s, and he still finished out 50 years with a return of something like over 1,000,000%. So that was my response to him, and then he responds saying, it doesn't answer at all whether you should sit on the sidelines now and re-enter after the collapse. So here is someone for an example where, yes, he's right, where if he says you should still sit on the sidelines now and re-enter after the collapse, what he's not saying is you have to be correct about when that collapse will happen, when the bottom is, and then actually have the guts to invest and not be run by fear. So if you have a, you know, here's the thing. Look, if you need the cash in 2 or 3 years, it's probably not appropriate to be buying stocks in the first place, because, you know, you can have corrections of 50% or more in a given year. God forbid if you have a retirement portfolio and you need that money next year in 2 years, then yes, what my friend is saying is correct, that you know, those asset prices can move against you even if the intrinsic, quote unquote, intrinsic value hasn't changed. But I mean, if you have a holding period of, you know, say 5 years, certainly 10 years or more, you should not be worried about whether there is a correction or not. And quite frankly, if you've been speculating and you just lost a lot of money, and when I say speculating, how I define speculating is you're buying an asset and you really don't know what the underlying intrinsic value is. And that's fine. I mean, it's okay if you don't know. The problem is that a lot of people will invest in a company and say, you know, I think this company has a great future. Okay, that's nice, but is the market valuing it at a price where that great future is already locked in, and potentially even more so? You know, you could have been right about technology, the industry of the internet, and still lost a lot of money in the 90s, or, you know, decades ago. You could have been right about semiconductors and lost a lot of money in semiconductor companies, or close to 100 years ago now, you could have been right about the automobile industry, yet the car companies that you invested in went bankrupt. So if you were doing that, and you were essentially gambling in the stock market, yeah, you can lose a lot of money. And I would say, you know, let this be a lesson to you. You know, actually feel the pain of losing a lot of money and have this be a wake-up call that, you know, hey, if I'm going to be investing in any kind of asset, I should have some kind of understanding of what I believe this asset to be worth and what I believe this asset will be worth in 5-10 years down the line. And if you can't make that, if you can't, you know, come up with a gauge and a range for that, and there's plenty of resources to learn how to do that, you know, you shouldn't be doing this yourself. And then you should either just buy, you know, just go buy an index fund, go to sleep for 50 years, or, you know, go put capital with someone who you trust to manage money with. And, you know, so if you don't know how to value businesses, and you're not, you know, then either make the conscious choice to learn how to do that, or make the conscious choice not to learn how to do that and give it to someone either who knows how to do that and has been doing it well over time, or just put it in an index fund. And, you know, it's very, very low fees, and don't worry about it. And the other thing too is that if there's a terrible, you know, the other way of thinking about this too is that, let's say my friend's right and there's a terrible, horrible, horrible collapse and everything goes to shit and all of that, you're going to have a lot more problems than just the stock market being down a lot. You mean, if there was a Great Depression type scenario, you know, there's going to be a lot more issues than just what your portfolio has. So yeah, don't put emergency funds in the stock market, and don't put money you'll need in next year in the market. But, you know, money that you're investing, you know, over a lifetime or over, you know, a decade, I wouldn't be concerned about this. Especially if you're someone who understands fundamental analysis, there's plenty of companies even that I've looked at today, that are certainly, I mean, more than very likely, I don't like to say anything certain in life, but more than very likely, trading at very significant discounts to what they're probably worth. And the rate of return on those assets over the next decade, you know, will be things you probably won't be complaining about. My other thoughts too, is, you know, if you look at people, I said this a little bit earlier, but if you look at people who have held off, you know, thought the market had been expensive, you know, there have been people actually who've been writing about how the market hasn't looked expensive since 2010. And some of those people, you know, had a massive portfolio of short positions, hedges, trying to, you know, make things more complicated by preparing for the downturn. Well, those people have been screwed. I mean, they've been really screwed. They've missed out on lots of corporate profit growth, you know, almost the past, 8 years now, and more. So I think if you're going to be, you know, investing for a long period of time, you want to be a net buyer of businesses, and whether that's buying a local business in your town, buying a farm, buying a rental property, or buying a stock, which, you know, represents a part of a business, you'll do fine. And I think what Travis said before, if you look at the long-term history of, you know, even the worst performance over 30 years, it's still a lot. But look, if you're buying a, you know, Warren Buffett talks about buying a dollar for 50 cents, right? So, I mean, if you're buying a dollar for 50 cents and then there's a market drop and now that same dollar is trading for 35 cents or 30 cents and you are confident that there's nothing that's been impaired with that dollar, well, that's really good news. I mean, that's not something you should be fretting about. If anything, you know, you should be a little bit more concerned when you can't find any dollars for 50 cents. That's when you should probably be a little bit more nervous. But, you know, the companies you invest in might be paying dividends. They might be buying back their own stock now at cheaper prices. I know certainly in the portfolios that I manage, quite a bit of the assets that represent AUM, you know, are buying, I would imagine, are buying back stock in the last few weeks. And I know they have a history of doing that. But yeah, if you've been speculating and, you know, buying something either because it's been popular, whether it's a stock or a bond or, you know, Bitcoin or you name it, gold, palladium, and, you know, you're just playing hot potato and you're hoping to flip that asset to somebody else at an even higher price, that's not investing. And it's better to lose money doing something like that on a smaller sum of assets than doing it correctly, you know, making money on that a few times, and then you think you're really, really smart. That's where you can get into a lot of trouble. So if you don't have, you know, so this is, I think, where people get confused is, you know, if you have a stock portfolio, your stock portfolio is now down, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50% in the last few months, and you're freaking out, and you're like, oh my God, I don't know what to do. Well, I would say, okay, what's the intrinsic value estimate of these securities that you have? And if the answer is, I don't have an intrinsic value estimate of these companies, well, here's the great news. You've been speculating with your money. You've been gambling. And, you know, that's, let that be a wake-up call to you and do something about it. So either learn how to analyze companies or admit that you're not willing to learn, go buy an index fund or go give it to someone who does know how to analyze companies and that you're confident in their ability to do so. There's a big difference between speculation and investing. And if you focus on investing, if a stock goes up 10% or a stock goes down 10% or down 10%, what matters is what do you believe the value of the business to be? And if you believe that the stock went up 10%, but the value of the business just doubled overnight, well, even though the price is 10% higher, it's actually significantly cheaper than it was, you know, at that lower price point, 10% below, right? So if you have a dollar and let's say you have a dollar and it's trading at a dollar, right? So it's trading at intrinsic value and then free cash flow goes up by 10%. The stock price goes up by, normalized free cash flow doubles, right, in a year, but the market price only goes up 10%. Well, now all of a sudden you have a $2 bill trading at $1.10 versus a dollar bill trading at a dollar. So is $1.10 is a higher price. But what matters is not the price. It's trading at a larger discount to your estimate of intrinsic value. On the flip side, if you have a dollar trading for 80 cents, now you have a correction in the market. You have whatever fears are there. That's another thing, too. If you look at financial history, there's every correction, there's some fear of something. And sometimes it's justified, sometimes it's not justified. But at the end of the, what is going to impact security prices is not a corrupt bank or a politician or a market manipulator or a short seller. You know, politicians love to blame those kinds of external factors on market prices. But what's going to move markets over time is that actual intrinsic value of the asset, you know, whether it's a bond or a company in liquidation or a piece of real estate or a rental property or a farm or a stock. And that's really how you have to think about things. And I think that's really all I have to say about that. If you have any questions for me more specifically, you can contact me, an intelligent, my email that I use for the show is intelligentinvesting@gmail.com. You can also find me on Facebook, Eric Schlein, or you can find me over LinkedIn. But yeah, please feel free to shoot me a message. If you want book recommendations, resources, recommendations to, other good money managers, and I'm more than happy to, you know, give you a list of quite a few of them and talk to them and make up your own mind. Again, I'm not going to give advice on the show, but I hope that for some of you who have been confused that this has provided some kind of clarity. And again, you can always reach out to me if you have any more questions. I love helping people. This is a field I'm passionate about. It kind of pains me, quite frankly, when I see people get terrified and scared and almost paralyzed at what to do with their investments. So I hope this helps. If you have any feedback for me, feel free to email me as well. And again, appreciate you listening. And if you like the show, I would love if you could take, 30 seconds, a minute of your time and write a review, an honest review. Hopefully it's a 5-star review, but if it's not, that's okay too, on the iTunes Music Store. And having those reviews and recommendations provides more of an audience for the show and gives me a wider reach to make a difference with it. So hope you enjoyed. And for those of you that celebrate Christmas, I hope you guys have a Merry Christmas. I'll be probably eating Chinese food tomorrow. I'm Jewish. But Merry Christmas and thanks for listening. Have a great rest of your 2018.
Thank you for listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast with Eric Schlein. If you'd like to connect with Eric for questions, comments, feedback, ideas, or to inquire about being on the show, please contact Eric at intelligentinvesting@gmail.com. So, in the words of Charlie Munger, I have nothing to add.